Randy Schuneman, one of her foreign policy tutors from St. Paul, was assigned the job. Davis had pleaded with Mark McKinnon, who had decided to sit out the general election because he wanted no part of flaying Obama, to ride to their rescue. He agreed, but just for that one night. After dinner, they all retreated to a small room tightly packed with two lecterns and a camera in one of the McCain compound's guest buildings. A run-through was attempted, in which Palin kept getting lost 15 seconds into her answers, stopping suddenly and saying, "No, no, wait, let me start over," or, "Shoot, I don't know this." The session ended after an hour. Schmidt, Mark Wallace, and McKinnon stepped outside into the cool desert air, the night pitch black around them. "What do you think?" Wallace asked McKinnon. "Oh, my God." The next day, Schmidt decreed the banishment of Palin's hundreds of index cards. Instead, she was given 25 or 30 containing full-blown questions and answers, based on her team's best guesses at what the debate queries would be, along with scripted pivots out of dangerous territory and onto safer ground. There was no time for Palin to learn enough to be turned into Jean Kirkpatrick in the next 48 hours, but after seeing her handle the prompter malfunction at the convention, Team McCain knew that she had an impressive capacity for learning by rote. They moved the lecterns aside and set them up by the creek for daytime rehearsals. Between sessions, Palin, dressed in a hockey jersey and soccer shorts, would go off by herself, sit on the porch or on a swing under a tree and study up on her preset questions, committing the answers to memory. The change of venue and routine seemed to have an effect. That night, Palin made it all the way through her formal run-through. When she finished, the room broke into applause. Priscilla Shanks, the speech coach who had worked with Palin at the convention, shouted out, "She's back! She's back!" Schmidt and Wallace took a dimmer, more angst-ridden view. Outside Sedona, the stakes around the debate had continued to rise. On October 1st, the night before the showdown, CBS ran the last and arguably the worst of the Couric clips, the one featuring Palin's muffed Supreme Court answer. The previous Saturday, Tina Fey had unleashed her second stab at Palin on SNL in a sketch spoofing the initial Couric sit-down, using nearly identical language to what the nominee had said about the bailout bill. A devastating mashup juxtaposing the reality with the parody was zooming around the web, and while Palin's performance in prep had improved markedly, she was still committing howlers that, if let loose during the debate, would be cataclysmic events. She also continued to stumble over an unavoidable element, her rival's name. Over and over, Palin referred to Obama's running mate as Senator O'Biden, or was it O'Biden? And the corrections from her team weren't sticking. Finally, three staffers practically in unison suggested, "Why don't you just call him Joe?" Palin stared at them quizzically and said, "But I've never met him." In far-off Delaware, things were running more smoothly, at least on the surface. At the Sheraton Suites Hotel in Wilmington, the opposing side had taken over the second floor and transformed it into a down-to-the-millimeter replica of the debate stage in St. Louis. The height of the lecterns, the distance between them, the lighting, the color scheme, all of it was identical to the real thing. And then the Obamans and Bidenettes saw the press pictures of Palin rehearsing in her gym shorts by a tree. They had to laugh. But only for a second. Then they went back to being tied up in knots with fear that Joe would botch his big moment. It wasn't hard to imagine how it could happen. The expectations for Palin were subterranean, while the bar for Biden was set around Jupiter. There wasn't much to win here, in other words, but there was plenty to lose, and there were at least two obvious ways that Biden could do it. He might be condescending to Palin because he thought she was an ignoramus, or he might be patronizing to her as a woman, which, given Joe's old-school Sinatra-esque tendencies, was just as likely. The Obamans were pushing a simple strategy. Ignore Palin. Don't engage her. Whatever happens, don't let her lure you down any rabbit holes with her crazy syntax and run-on sentences. But Joe couldn't resist. Not at first. A week or two before the 3 days of formal debate camp started on September 29th, the campaign put him through his paces in a mock run-through against Anita Dunn. She played the part by reading from a script assembled almost entirely out of verbatim Palin quotes. "That's too incoherent," Biden exclaimed. "Is that really what she says? No, that can't be her answer. But I mean, she's not saying anything. How am I supposed to respond to that, folks?" And into the rabbit hole he went. It only got worse once they brought in the actual stand-in for Palin, the governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm. Lithe and alluring like Palin, Granholm came with talking points and a strategy, having glutted herself on YouTube videos of Palin's Alaska debates. Pushing the readiness regimen past the point of absurdity, the Obamans ran Granholm through her own pre-prep against a fake Biden. The result was a perfect Palin, charming, folksy, disciplined, flirty, and mean. Biden's first sessions with Granholm were bad enough to put a scare into Axelrod and Plouffe. Biden was in meet-the-press mode, ponderous and long-winded. Granholm, aware that family was Biden's soft spot, made cracks about his son Hunter's lobbying history, and Joe turned defensive. When Granholm dangled bait by playing dumb, he turned scornful and chauvinistic. But Biden worked diligently with Michael Sheehan, who trained him using what Sheehan, with due generational aptness, dubbed an Arthur Murray pattern. Describe the situation, explain how it will be worse under McCain, describe how it will be better under us. 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Biden quickly got the hang of it. He also figured out other means of avoiding rabbit holes. In one session, Granholm was tossing in non sequiturs, explanations that started nowhere and ended up even further off the map, when she tried to entice Joe into hole diving with an answer on race that concluded with a wayward reference to guess who's coming to dinner. Biden paused. I really have nothing to add to that. By the night of the debate, the Obamans were expressing confidence, but their doubts weren't far beneath the surface. You feel like he's ready? Obama asked Dunn an hour before the debate. He's totally ready, Dunn assured him, and herself. You know, Obama said, I think I'm just going to watch this by myself. The debate began with its best-known moment. Palin striding on stage in a fitted black suit, extending a hand to Biden and saying, Hey, can I call you Joe? From there, the next 90 minutes unfolded as almost no one expected they would. Neither Palin nor Biden gaffed. Neither said anything egregiously stupid. Neither went for the other's throat, as both aimed their shots at the top of the opposite ticket. When it was over, the Obamans exhaled and Biden was triumphal. Coming off the stage, he said to his aides, You guys owe me. You don't know how much restraint that took. McCain world was ecstatic. 5 days earlier, many of them had feared that Palin's psychological fragility might lead to a fiasco. Palin had not only survived, but fought Biden to something like a draw. In their suite at the Four Seasons, the Palins stayed up past midnight celebrating, drinking champagne, talking about what came next. More rallies, more rope lines, and more attacks on Obama. Let's go, let's go, let's go, Palin said. Let's get out there and win this election. The debate propelled her back onto the trail with a fresh head of steam, a renewed sense of confidence, and an appetite for Obama's jugular. On October 4th, the New York Times provided Palin an opportunity to capitalize on all three when it published a front-page article about the topic that Hillary Clinton always believed would come back to bite Obama, former Weather Underground subversive William Ayers. Though the story concluded that Obama and Ayers do not appear to have been close, the next day McCain World instructed Palin by email to lay into the Democratic nominee as someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country. Palin eagerly agreed, and with the few syntactical tweaks, delivered the message as written. For McCain World, it would be one of precious few times in the election's final month that Palin stuck to the script. With the debate-related tumult behind them and any possibility gone that Palin would be a game-changer, McCain's strategist hoped that she would continue to be useful in firing up the base and not create too many disruptions or distractions. But it wasn't long before the signs appeared that Palin was going rogue. The most widely publicized example was an interview she gave to the Times in-house conservative columnist William Kristol on October 5th, the same day she thrashed Obama for palling around with terrorists. When Kristol asked why, if Ayers was on the table, Reverend Wright was not, Palin said that Obama's pastor should be fair game and implicitly criticized McCain for not leading the charge. McCain was rarely bothered when Palin scampered off message, mainly because he did the same so often himself, but this was an exception. He'd drawn a hard line around Wright and couldn't understand why his running mate would have crossed it. At the same time, Palin was waging a persistent internal crusade to reverse one of the campaign's major strategic decisions. On the day of the VP debate, McCain World let it be known that it was pulling its resources out of Michigan, a key battleground state that it had determined was out of reach in the wake of the financial crisis. Palin had visited there more than once, thought she connected with its blue-collar voters and could put the state back in play, and lobbied to be allowed to return. When her traveling chief of staff, Andrew Smith, pointed out to her that McCain, Schmidt, and Davis had reached their conclusion on the basis of complex calculations involving the polls and the budget, Palin simply shrugged and uttered one of her signature phrases, "I know what I know what I know." Regardless of what Palin thought she knew, Schmidt and Davis turned her down flat about venturing back into Michigan. But Palin refused to give in, sending email after email suggesting ways that she could squeeze a visit to the Wolverine State into her schedule. "It's a cheap 4-hour drive from Wisconsin. I'll pay for the gas," Palin wrote to the senior staff on October 8th. "I'd just be sleeping at that midnight drive time anyway." She was emerging as a big-time control freak. With her family now accompanying her most everywhere, making air travel logistics a pain, she directed the campaign to schedule bus transportation instead of flights wherever possible, even if that means late-night drives in the bus. She became maniacal about monitoring her media coverage. She was constantly channel surfing and blogosphere mining, and when she came across any mention that was less than flattering, she insisted that her staff try to have it corrected. Palin also showed an unusual wariness about the politicians and donors brought aboard her campaign plane and bus, insisting that she pre-screen them before their seats were confirmed. "I want to Google them myself so I can know my comfort level," she emailed her team on October 9th. "Photos, etc. with them may come back to haunt me if I can't vet these folks myself." Palin's concern with such appearances was seen by some as an indication that she already had her sights set on 2012, but in truth, she and Todd continued to be far more preoccupied by her status in Alaska than just about anything else. Any issue related to the state put them on high alert and incited some of their worst propensities toward parsimoniousness with the truth. On October 10th, when the Alaska legislature issued a report on Troopergate stating that Palin had abused her powers but not broken the law, Palin proclaimed to reporters that she'd been cleared of all wrongdoing. When her staff told her she would have to walk back her statement because it wasn't true, she said, "Well, why was I told otherwise?" neglecting the fact that her talking points had made the results of the report quite plain. A few days later, Palin got into a fight with Schmidt when she insisted that the campaign put out a statement denying Todd's involvement in the Alaskan Independence Party. Palin contended that Todd had mistakenly registered with the party and rectified the error. She also claimed the party had nothing to do with secession. Schmidt curtly informed her that secession was the party's reason for existence and that, according to the campaign's records, Todd had been a member for 7 years. For Schmidt and Davis, Palin was a time sink the size of the Lake Eyre Basin. She pestered them with complaints that her schedules were so tight that she didn't have time to get in a daily run. She never took no for an answer. She just kept asking different senior staffers until she found someone who told her what she wanted to hear. Every media opportunity put before her produced a conniption. In mid-October, Palin was considering an offer to do a guest spot on Saturday Night Live. Schmidt was in favor, saying it would show the country that she could laugh at herself. After watching some clips, Palin was chary. "I had no idea how gross celebrities could get," she wrote in an email to HQ. "These folks are whack." Palin eventually came around and did the program on October 18th. The moment that everyone was waiting for was fleeting. She and Tina Fey crossed paths briefly on screen, but spoke not a word to each other. Even so, the charge from it was electric, and rightly so. For all the emphasis McCain World had placed on Palin's big three image-making challenges, none of them had done as much to shape public perception of her as Fey and Couric. Pop culture has always been a part of presidential contests, but never before had there been anything quite like the Fey-Couric double act. Two uptown New York women working independently but in tandem, one engaged in eviscerating satire, the other in even-handed journalism. The composite portrait they drew of Palin was viral and omnipresent. The sparkle of celebrity made it irresistible and devastating. Faced with the footage of Reverend Wright, Obama was able to slay the dragon with his words. Faced with Fey-Couric, Palin was powerless. Everything she did or said only fed the beast. By the time she went on SNL, the definitional war over her had ended. She retained the ardor and loyalty of her fans, who continued to turn out for her, root for her, and defend her, But in the eyes of the broader public, and even more so those of the national media and political establishments, any trace of her image as a maverick reformer had been erased. For them, Palin had been reduced to nothing more than a hick and a high wire. Rogue as Sarah Palin may have gone that October, she didn't have a monopoly on the practice, even among running mates. The debate aside, Biden had basically been coloring outside the line since the Democratic convention. With the Palin tornado making so much noise and kicking up so much debris, it just wasn't nearly as noticeable until one day it was. In an effort to demonstrate his commitment to being a team player, Biden told Obama when he accepted the VP slot, "I'll do anything you want me to do, but there are two things I won't do. I won't wear a funny hat, and I won't mess with my brand." The Biden brand meant a great deal to Joe, almost as much as the Biden name. To him, the brand was about substance, about truth-telling, about making hard choices, even if they were politically awkward or painful. Biden thought of it as a Democratic version of the McCain brand, the old McCain brand, that is. But what Biden quickly discovered was that Obama's policies were awfully thin, not terribly specific, more rhetoric than substance. Right after the convention, at a prep session at his house in Wilmington for an appearance on Meet the Press, Biden listened to a bunch of the Obamans talk him through the Democratic ticket's position on taxes. "That's our policy? That's our policy?" he said incredulously. "Well, it's your campaign. I'll say what you want me to say, but after Election Day, all bets are off." Then one day in the middle of September, a disturbing bulletin reached O-Town. Apparently, Biden had been hanging around with the reporters in the back of his new plane, running his mouth about how he was more qualified to be president than Obama. On paper, of course, it was arguably true, but that didn't make it go down any easier with the suits. Actually, it struck a nerve. Axelrod was a fan of Joe's, but this made him angry. He and Pluff had warned Biden about precisely this kind of scenario that August day in Wilmington. Right out of the chute, Joe was breaking the deal they'd made. A chill set in between Chicago and the Biden plane. Joe and Obama barely spoke by phone, rarely campaigned together. Not only was Biden kept off Obama's nightly campaign conference call, he wasn't even told it existed. When the idea of having Biden join was put to Pluff, his response was, "Nah." A different daily call was set up for Joe, with the Davids, so they could keep a tight rein on him. The frostiness soon began to run in both directions. Biden had an endless stream of complaints about Chicago. He was frustrated with the staff, didn't like the advertising, didn't love how he was being deployed. After his comments about being more qualified than Obama, his access to the press was severely limited, and he didn't like that either. "Are you part of the Chicago team, or are you on my team?" Biden would ask new staffers dispatched to join his roadshow. "Are you with me, or are you with them?" Then the Cold War turned icy, when Biden started making public gaffes, some politically maladroit and some just plain goofy. In the span of a few days in late September, he equated patriotism with paying higher taxes, made a comment at odds with Obama's position on clean coal, and offered a historical reference to the 1929 stock market crash in which he said that FDR was then the president, it was Hoover, and went on television, which hadn't yet been invented, to soothe the nation. In an interview with Couric, Biden was asked about an Obama TV ad that knocked McCain for being computer illiterate. "I thought that was terrible," Biden said. "I didn't know we did it, and if I had anything to do with it, we never would have done it." In Chicago, irritation mounted over Biden's indiscipline, not least inside Obama, whose unflappability burst into flames when it came to his running mate. One night during a debate prep session, Obama approached one of his advisors and said grumpily, "When are you going to fix this problem with Biden?" Joe's insertion of both feet into his mouth on October 20th took the tensions into a new and nasty place. At a fundraiser in Seattle, Biden seemed to be showing off for the wealthy donors, trying to impress them with his far-seeing vision, his exclusive knowledge. Also, he wasn't at his sharpest. He was dog-tired and had a cold. "Mark my words," he told the muckety-mucks, "it will not be 6 months before the world tests Barack Obama like they did John Kennedy. Watch, we're going to have an international crisis, a generated crisis, to test the mettle of this guy." On Obama's nightly call, the candidate hit the ceiling. Axelrod was already up there, needing to be peeled off, having let fly a string of F-bombs when he first found out what Biden had said. "Golly, man," Obama said with more anger in his voice than gollies normally carry. He was, in fact, as pissed off as most people on the call had ever heard him, more so than he'd been at even the wickedest jabs from Hillary Clinton. "How many times is Biden going to say something stupid?" Obama asked if Silas Doyle, Biden's chief of staff, was on the call. "Yes, I'm here," she said abashedly. "Listen," said Obama, "tell Joe I love him. I love him, but he can't be doing this." A couple of days later, Obama phoned Biden and laid into him. "You're supposed to have my back," he said, "not be out there creating problems." With 2 weeks to go before Election Day, Biden's remark was gift-wrapped booty for the McCain campaign, a ready-made TV spot. And indeed, soon after the comment, just such an ad hit the air, complete with Biden's voice and pictures of terrorists and a frightened child. Its message spoke directly to the stubbornest doubts that some voters still had about Obama and to their fears about the risks entailed in electing him. More than that, though, what rankled Obama was that Biden hadn't bothered to pick up the phone and apologize. Worse, Biden didn't say that he was sorry when Obama called. He showed no remorse for his Seattle comments or understanding that they posed a real political problem. Biden knew he'd screwed up, of course, but he went into a defensive crouch. He told his aides it wasn't really a gaffe, that he was just speaking the truth, as the Biden brand demanded. He got a little chippy. "Well, gosh," Biden said, "I guess it's a good thing I didn't say anything about bitter people who cling to their guns and religion." On October 22nd, Palin ticked the box next to the only remaining network to which he had yet to grant a sit-down, NBC. After finishing her talk with anchor Brian Williams, she tapped out an email to the campaign senior staff that had an air of resignation and a certain poignancy. "Was not a good interview," Palin wrote. "So hang on to your hat with the criticism and mocking that will ensue. Just a heads up, doubt anything can be done about it. The gotcha question started right out of the chute, and as usual, I was perplexed at the whole line of questioning, and I'm sure that showed through." Palin was still as rogue as ever, but the thrill was gone. The only pleasure she seemed to take was in her crowds. She worked her rope lines hungrily for 2 hours at a time, lingering over every hand she touched. Otherwise, Palin was demoralized, isolated, and confused. On her plane, when confronted with an uncomfortable topic by her advisors, she was still dropping her head and refusing to respond, even as they stood there awkwardly waiting for a reply. She had no idea whom to trust anymore or really where to turn. On the day of the NBC interview, Politico broke a story that the RNC had spent $150,000 for clothing for her and her family. It was the first shoe to drop in what, over the next week, would become a hailstorm of expensive footwear. CNN reported that someone close to the campaign called her a diva. Politico reported that a top McCain advisor called her a whack job. The maelstrom not only eclipsed Biden's mega-gaffe, but signaled the death of whatever was left of Palin mania. The invective was the visible outcropping of a deeper fault line. McCain world had split into internecine factions surrounding Palin and her candidacy, roughly divided between those who still had faith in Palin and those who did not. The tensions were bursting forth in the form of proxy warfare in the media, infuriating McCain. Schmidt and Davis ordered the campaign's email system searched to determine who was behind the snipes in the press. Palin's loyalists on her plane pointed at Nicole and Mark Wallace for the diva comment. In fact, the source was veteran Republican fundraiser and strategist Wayne Berman, a close friend of McCain's. Palin had long since lost faith in McCain world. She felt belittled and lectured to by the senior staff. Whenever an aide told her Schmidt was waiting to talk to her on the phone, Palin's reflexive reaction was, "Do I have to?" She was raising so much money for the campaign and drawing such mammoth crowds, yet she received no respect in return. "If I'm doing all this," she would ask, "why can't I have input?" Increasingly, she was a picture of isolation, either listening to her iPod or surfing cable channels on the seatback TV on her plane. When politicians or donors traveled with her, she rarely spoke more than a few words of greeting to them. She stared at her speech text and avoided engagement. The truth was, the McCain people did fail Palin. They had, as promised, made her one of the most famous people in the world overnight, but they allowed her no time to plant her feet to absorb such a seismic shift. They were unprepared when they picked her, which made her look even more unready than she was. They banked on the force of her magnetism to compensate for their disarray. They amassed polling points and dollars off of her fiery charisma and then left her to burn up in the inferno of public opinion. The face-to-face exposure of the campaign's senior advisors to Palin was minimal in the last month before Election Day. She was on the road, they were at headquarters or with McCain, their paths rarely intersecting. But after witnessing her near breakdown during debate prep and monitoring her subsequently by phone and email, some in the upper echelons of McCain world began to believe that Palin was unfit for high office. McCain was aware that his senior team considered Palin troubled and troubling, but he was shielded from the fullness of their distress. Several of his lieutenants agreed that should McCain's electoral prospects miraculously improve and winning in November become likely, they would have to confront the nominee as he started to plan how his administration would function. It would be essential, they believed, that Palin be relegated to the largely ceremonial role that pre-modern vice presidents inhabited. It was inconceivable that Palin undertake the duties of a Gore or a Cheney, or that, if McCain fell ill or died, the country be left in the hands of a President Palin. Some in McCain world were ridden with guilt over elevating Palin to within striking distance of the White House. They were hardly alone in such harsh judgments. Obama, who had cautioned his advisors not to jump to conclusions about Palin's potential when she was first selected, ultimately came to believe that the process used to pick her, the man who did the picking, and the woman who was picked were all suspect. He took to mimicking Palin's stylized "you betcha" in front of his campaign team. In late October, Obama's focus group maestro, David Binder, was conducting a session with a group of swing voters in a Cleveland suburb. A middle-aged woman let loose with a string of not unfamiliar broadsides against Obama. "He's a Muslim. He's soft on terrorism because he's a Muslim. He doesn't put his hand on his heart during patriotic rituals. We're not even sure he was born in this country." Binder was confused. This was supposed to be a group of undecided voters. "If you think all these terrible things about Obama," he asked the woman, "how can you possibly be undecided?" "Because if McCain dies, Palin would be president," she said. Chapter 23. The Finish Line. 35,000 souls filled the sprawling field in Kissimmee, Florida, just outside Orlando. It was nearly midnight on October 29th, and the air was shockingly cold, but people didn't seem to mind. They were there to get a glimpse of history, to feel the magic, to witness the commingling of the Democratic future and the Democratic past. They were there for the one and only joint campaign appearance of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Obama and Clinton came out on stage, clasped hands in the air, and then 42 began to speak. His 13-minute talk was amped up to the point of being hyperactive. He flapped his arms, clenched his fists, pointed toward the sky. "Folks, we can't fool with this," Clinton said. "Our country is hanging in the balance. This man should be our president." Obama returned the compliments, singing a song in the key of Clinton, praising his economic record, calling him a great president, a great statesman, a great supporter, a political genius, and a beloved figure around the world. Yet, beyond the histrionics and the headline, Barack and Bill finally side by side, the chemistry between the two still seemed less than stable, the body language awkward. Clinton's speech was formulaic, lacking a single warm personal anecdote or insight, both trademarks of his. Obama's expression conveyed no greater satisfaction than if he were being endorsed by the mayor of Kissimmee. The subject of Clinton campaigning on Obama's behalf had come up 7 weeks earlier, when the two men finally had their much-anticipated tete-a-tete. Obama, who was in New York on September 11th for various memorial events, ventured to Clinton's Harlem office for lunch. Though he showed deference to Clinton by walking in alone, no staff, no security, no posse, and respect for his stature by asking questions about governance instead of politics, the meeting had a stilted feel. Clinton's staff and the Obamans had engaged in a tug-of-war over whether to include a Harlem stroll and photo op as part of the visit, with each side ascribing ulterior race-related motives to the other. Obama, who had a vicious stomach bug, spent much of the lunch trying not to puke on Clinton's shoes. Clinton offered to hit the trail for or with Obama, but neither party was thrilled by the prospect. Clinton told CNN's Larry King that he planned to start after the Jewish holidays, which he'd never been known to observe. The Obamans, meanwhile, had determined through their polling that Clinton's presence would help only in a handful of states, mainly with Latinos. Not only would the Florida event be held in Hispanic-heavy suburban Orlando, but it would also feature actor Jimmy Smits. Their primary interest in holding a joint event, one joint event, was to keep the press from badgering them about doing none. That Clinton could be of service to Obama in so few places was as much a testament to the latter's strength as to the former's weaknesses. By the start of the last full week of the campaign, an NBC News Wall Street Journal survey had Obama up by 10 points. The ABC News Washington Post tracking poll put the number at 11. He was leading in every state won by Kerry in 2004, and either ahead or within the margin of error in 10 states carried by Bush in the previous election: Colorado, Florida, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, Nevada, New Mexico, North Carolina, Ohio, and Virginia. The significance of Obama's financial advantage over McCain was impossible to overstate. Armed with tens of millions that kept pouring into O-Town over the web, the campaign was moving cash around the country as if it were Monopoly money. Just before the Kissimmee rally, Obama and Biden had taken part in an unprecedented 30-minute primetime infomercial that cost $7 million and ran on CBS, NBC, MSNBC, Fox, BET, TV One, and Univision, attracting 33 million viewers, nearly twice the number of the top-rated network show, Dancing with the Stars. By the end of October, Obama and his team were beginning to face the fact. Victory was within their grasp. With Wall Street in flames and the economy falling further into recession, Obama knew that the challenges that awaited him in the White House would be daunting. On the stump, he seized the mantle of FDR, repeating the famous line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." His aides began reading books about Roosevelt's first 100 days in office, and also, yes, Team of Rivals. With such burdens looming, Obama put aside the petty and personal, reconciling with his running mate. The repair of the breach was initiated by Biden, whose close aide Tony Blinken figured out from his sources in the campaign that Obama was still angry over Joe's failure to apologize for his Seattle remarks. When Blinken explained why it might have gotten under Obama's skin, Biden said, "Oh, I get that." Biden called Obama and came quickly to the point. "You know what, I've got to tell you, I was totally remiss," he said. "I want you to know I understand that what I did was not only bad for me, it was bad for you, and it endangered our common prospects. I never said I was sorry, and I want to apologize." Obama was grateful. Biden felt magnanimous. A warm and lengthy conversation ensued with more to come. After weeks of distance, a partnership was taking root. Joe was a proud guy. Acts of contrition didn't come naturally to him, but this one, he admitted, was worth it, and no funny hat was required. McCain never needed a rapprochement with his running mate. On the upswing and the down, through the nastiest and gnarliest moments, not an ill word escaped his lips regarding Palin. If McCain was disappointed in her or in his own judgment, he hid it from even his closest intimates. He treated Palin chivalrously, inquiring regularly about her well-being and that of her family. "We asked a lot of her," McCain said, and he meant it. McCain blamed Palin's problems on the press and on members of his team for feeding the hounds. The leak-fueled stories about her drove him so nuts that he stopped watching cable news. His staff convinced him that leaving the TV tuned to ESPN would be a boon to his spirits. Indeed, both John and Cindy held the media responsible for much of what had gone wrong in the home stretch of the campaign, and that was a long list. October had been a month of misery for the McCains. The second and third debates with Obama had gone no better than the first. In Nashville, Tennessee, on October 7th, they'd met in a town hall-style format that should by all rights have worked to McCain's advantage. Instead, he rattled around the stage looking slightly lost, like a crazy uncle in search of a bathroom, one of his top advisors thought, making hokey jokes that fell flat, flinging edgy barbs and telling stories that referenced Ronald Reagan, Teddy Roosevelt, Tip O'Neill, and Herbert Hoover, making him seem every bit his age and then some. 8 days later, at Hofstra University in New York, McCain started strong and got off his best line of all three confrontations. "Senator Obama, I am not President Bush. If you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago." But the split-screen format used for the final debate enhanced the focus on McCain's facial expressions. He smirked, glowered, scowled, rolled his eyes. He looked angry. The Insta polls after each debate told the same story. Viewers judged Obama the winner of both by somewhere between 20 and 30 points. McCain was frustrated and resentful. The campaign had planned to carpet bomb Obama with negative ads in October, including some that would have used his own voice from the audio versions of his books. With the economy unraveling, however, McCain World realized such tactics would seem cheap and hollow, and would be ineffective to boot. But now McCain lashed out at his opponent on his own in ways remarkable for their tone and subtext, suggesting that Obama was a dangerous, possibly corrupt, possibly Manchurian unknown. "Who is the real Barack Obama?" McCain said at a New Mexico event 2 days after the Times published its piece on Ayers. "What does he plan for America?" 48 hours later, he referred directly to the former weatherman. "He wasn't a guy in the neighborhood. Obama launched his political career in his living room." Cindy McCain was equally vitriolic, a startling turnabout from a woman who for so long shunned the spotlight. "Obama has waged the dirtiest campaign in American history," she said one day. The next, she averred about the Democratic nominee's position on a war funding measure. "The day that Senator Obama cast a vote not to fund my son when he was serving sent a cold chill through my body." A week later, she reprised her attack on Michelle Obama before a pom-pom-waving crowd in Florida. "Yes," Cindy said, "I have always been proud of my country." As the election barreled toward its conclusion, something dark and frightening was unleashed, freed in part by the words of the McCains and Palin. At rallies across the country, there were jagged outbursts of rage and accusations of sedition hurled at Obama. In Pennsylvania and New Mexico, McCain audience members were captured on video and audio calling the Democrat a terrorist. In Wisconsin, Obama was described as a hooligan and a socialist. With the brutish dynamic apparently on the verge of hurtling out of control, a chagrined McCain attempted to rein it in. In Minnesota, when a man in the crowd said he would be afraid to raise a child in America if Obama were elected, McCain responded, "He is a decent person and not a person you have to be scared of as president." A few minutes later, he refuted a woman who called Obama an Arab. McCain's efforts to tamp down the furies were valorous, though they did nothing to erase his role in triggering the reaction in the first place. The civil rights hero John Lewis, whom McCain admired enormously, compared the Republican nominee and his running mate to George Wallace and said they were playing with fire. Another prominent African-American was watching with alarm. Colin Powell had been friends with McCain for 25 years. The senator had been actively seeking his endorsement, as had Obama, for nearly 2 years. Powell warned McCain that his greatest reservation was the intolerant tone that seemed to be overtaking the Republican Party. McCain's selection of Palin bothered Powell because he saw her as polarizing. He was dismayed by McCain's deployment of Ayers as an issue, perceived it as pandering to the right. And then there were the hate-soaked rallies, which he considered anti-American. "This isn't what we're supposed to be," he thought. Powell had leaned towards staying neutral, but these outbursts were all too much, and McCain had moved only belatedly to stop them. Obama, by contrast, had displayed terrific judgment during the financial crisis, Powell thought, and his campaign had been run with military precision. The show of overwhelming force struck the general as a political realization of the Powell doctrine. On October 19th, he endorsed Obama on Meet the Press. The general's repudiation was a stinging blow for McCain. Beyond their longtime friendship, Powell represented the same brand of Republicanism as McCain's: tough on defense, fiscally prudent, pragmatic and non-doctrinaire. McCain had to wonder what had become of him if his current incarnation was repelling someone like Powell. He was startled by the crazies at his rallies. Who were they? Why were they there? And what did they see in him? In the final 2 weeks of the race, McCain began to try to salvage something of his reputation. He put away the harshest of the personal invective against Obama and went back to talking about the economy, rash spending, and Iraq. He seemed ever more resigned in his public comments to a graceful exit. "I've had a wonderful life," McCain told Fox News. "I have to go back and live in Arizona and be in the United States Senate representing them, and with a wonderful family and daughters and sons that I'm so proud of, and a life that's been blessed." He wanted to go out on a high note to recapture some of the old McCain spark, but it was hard to do. On November 1st, he and Cindy appeared on Saturday Night Live. In a skit that cast him as a TV huckster, he fell flat. On the same day, he received the most unwanted endorsement in the universe, that of Dick Cheney. There was no love lost between Cheney and McCain, who'd clashed bitterly over the conduct of the war in Iraq, the performance of Donald Rumsfeld, and interrogation techniques. When Cheney's friends learned about the endorsement, they laughed. That wasn't Cheney saluting McCain, they thought. It was him flipping the senator the bird. The next day, McCain traveled to New Hampshire for one last town hall meeting in the state, where his presidential aspirations first took wing. The trip made absolutely no sense politically. The polls had Obama ahead there by double digits, but McCain had been agitating for the Granite State curtain call since a visit there in mid-October. To Mike Dennehy, his top New Hampshire strategist, he said, "I want to go to Peterborough." Dennehy knew that McCain World HQ would resist. "Just call them and make it happen," McCain said. Peterborough, population 6,100, was the place where McCain first tasted the flavor of a New Hampshire town hall in 1999. Just 19 people attended. Months later, the Peterborough townhouse was packed on the eve of his galvanizing 2000 primary win, and the scene had repeated itself in January 2008 as he pulled off another, albeit very different, New Hampshire surprise. And so, in the early evening of November 2nd, McCain made the hour-long bus trip west from Manchester Airport, a lunatic expenditure of time in the final hours of a national campaign, but his superstitions were in full flower. On the bus, he swapped memories with some of his old New Hampshire hands. Dennehy recalled that the first time in Peterborough, they had to bribe people with free ice cream to get anyone to come. "I'm glad we're going back," McCain said wistfully. "We've come full circle." Standing with Cindy on stage in the Peterborough townhouse, dressed in a black jacket with its collar upturned and an open-necked shirt, McCain took questions from the packed hall for half an hour and ended with a flourish. "My friends, it's time for all of us to stand up and fight for America. America is in difficulty. We've got to fight for America. We've got to fight for our children. We've got to fight for freedom and justice. We've got to fight for the men and women who are serving in the military. We've got to fight for America, the things we stand for and believe in. Our best days are ahead of us. America never quits. America never gives up. We will succeed. We will win. Let's win this election and get our economy and our country going again." McCain was no fool. He could and did read the polls as closely as anyone. But in every candidate, fatalism, realism, and hope live in delicate equipoise. McCain's pollster, Bill McInturff, was seeing some tightening in the numbers around the country. Obama wasn't over 50%. The electoral math was difficult, but not impossible. Some of the key battleground states seemed to be in reach. New Hampshire had closed to 4, McCain had heard. Maybe the smart set had it all wrong. Maybe an upset was still somehow possible. Maybe, maybe, maybe. As McCain was getting off his campaign bus at the airport, about to bid adieu to the state he loved so much and that loved him so much back, he turned to Dennehy, a flash of optimism in his eyes, and asked, "How many we down by?" Dennehy knew the truth, but couldn't bear putting it into words. "Let's not talk about that tonight," he said. As McCain was departing New Hampshire, Obama was arriving in Cleveland, Ohio, rolling up to find 80,000 people on the city's downtown outdoor mall listening to Bruce Springsteen belt out Thunder Road. At the end of Springsteen's set, Obama took the stage with Michelle and the girls and shared a warm moment with Bruce, his wife Patty, and their kids. Springsteen, who hit the trail in 2004 for Carrie, had joked earlier about being glad to be invited back, not being seen as some kind of jinx. Now Obama added to the levity. When he got to the part in his speech where he asked the crowd how many of them made more than $250,000 a year, the floor for his proposed tax increases, the one made a point of telling the boss to keep his hand down. Obama brought up McCain's endorsement by Cheney, noting that the VP had said he was delighted to support the GOP nominee. "You've never seen Dick Cheney delighted, but he is. It's kind of hard to picture, but it's true." As Obama giggled, the skies grew dark and it began to drizzle. "Did you notice that it started when I started talking about Dick Cheney?" Obama joked. "That's all right. We've been through an 8-year storm, but a new day is dawning. Sunshine is on the way." The next morning, November 3rd, Obama woke up in Jacksonville, Florida, to the heaviest of all weather. On the last day of his presidential campaign, his grandmother, Madeline Dunham, had died at 86. The news came as no surprise to Obama. Dunham had fought a long battle with cancer and had been at death's door for months. 10 days earlier, Obama had briefly absented himself from the trail to fly to Hawaii to see her, knowing all too well that it could be for the last time. Dunham had been Obama's guardian for much of his youth, while his mother lived in Indonesia. He called her Toot, she called him Bear. He wanted desperately for her to make it to Election Day, to live to see him achieve his dream. Obama betrayed no emotion in Jacksonville. His speech at Veterans Memorial Arena that morning was rousing. He recalled that on September 15th, McCain had appeared in the same venue and declared that the fundamentals of our economy are strong. Well, Florida, you and I know that's not only fundamentally wrong, it also sums up his out of touch on your own economic philosophy, Obama said. A philosophy that will end when I am president of the United States of America. Obama's next stop was in Charlotte, North Carolina, late that afternoon, where 25,000 people gathered to see him in a field opposite Duke Centennial Hall at the University of North Carolina. The weather had been fine all day long, but as soon as Obama's jet touched down, the skies began to threaten. As the crowd waited for him, the heavens opened up and a vicious downpour began. On the way to the event, Obama stopped by his Charlotte headquarters to shake hands with volunteers and call a few voters. When one of the voters raised the subject of health care, Obama turned away from the pool reporters and said into the phone, "Obviously, this is happening in my own family. My grandmother stayed at home until recently." When he turned back, Obama was visibly deflated, looking drawn and tired. When he finally arrived in the field at UNC, the rain had stopped, the crowd was drenched, and they were ready for him. He stepped to the lectern and began his speech with a remembrance of his grandmother. He said, "She died peacefully in her sleep with my sister at her side, and so there's great joy as well as tears," he said. "She's gone home." Haltingly, he said, "I'm not going to talk about it too long because it's hard to talk about." Even so, Obama wanted everyone to know a little about Toot. He called her a quiet hero, like a lot of quiet heroes in the crowd and in the country. "They're not famous," Obama continued. "Their names aren't in the newspaper, but each and every day they work hard. They watch out for their families. They sacrifice for their families. That's what America's about. That's what we're fighting for." As Obama said all this, his voice was mostly steady, but tears were streaming down his cheeks. The first time he had wept publicly since taking the national stage. Obama reached inside his pocket, pulled out a white handkerchief, wiped his eyes, and carried on, returning several times to the woman who had shaped his character as much as anyone in the world. A few hours later, Obama and his traveling crew pulled into the Prince William County Fairground in Manassas, Virginia, for his final campaign rally. The scene was surreal, mind-boggling, like something out of a movie. The buses rolled up into a muddy parking lot behind the stage. The floodlights illuminated a swirling mist rising into the dark night sky. Beyond the camera, risers surrounding the stage were a pair of trucks with uniformed, heavily armed Secret Service tactical teams standing on top, scanning the horizon through their binoculars. And beyond the trucks were some 90,000 Obama fans on a gently sloping hillside, stretching literally as far as the eye could see. How fully Obama understood the alchemy or the tides of history, the collision of man and moment that brought him to that place, putting him on the verge of winning the White House, was impossible to know. But he seemed to grasp the need for closure. At the end of his speech, he returned to the story of Edith Childs, the city councilwoman in Greenwood, South Carolina, who early in his campaign bequeathed to him the rallying cry that marked his breakthrough in the Iowa caucuses. "Fired up, ready to go." Obama hadn't uncorked this riff in months, but he turned on the turbochargers in Manassas and delivered it with gusto, coiling his body, bouncing up and down, sweeping his arms, tracing with his fingers in the air. By the time he got to the end, "One voice can change a room, and if it can change a room, it can change a city, and if it can change a city, it can change a state, and if it can change a state, then it can change a nation, and if it can change a nation, it can change a world. Come on, Virginia. Let's go change the world." The crowd let loose a roar that shook the ground beneath their feet. Returning to the airport, Obama boarded his jet and prepared to head back to Chicago. He made his way down the aisle and into the rear cabin, where the press corps mingled. He thanked the reporters for having accompanied him on his astonishing ride. He gave a photographer a birthday kiss. He shook every hand on the plane. "Okay, guys," Obama said. "Let's go home. It'll be fun to see how the story ends." Epilogue. Together at last. On the morning of November 5th, Barack Obama had breakfast with his family, saw his kids off to school, donned sunglasses, and went to the gym. The previous night, the nation's first African-American president-elect had secured a victory that was as dazzling as it was historic. His 53% of the popular vote was the largest majority secured by a Democrat since Lyndon Johnson. He swept the blue states, captured the battlegrounds of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, and picked up red states across the country: Colorado, Indiana, North Carolina, Virginia. He dominated among black voters, 95-4, Hispanic voters, 66-32, and young voters, 66-32. His share of the white vote, 43%, was higher than what Gore or Kerry had attained, and among whites age 18-29, he trounced McCain 68-31. Obama made his way to his transition headquarters on the 38th floor of the Kleczynski Federal Building in Chicago's Loop. Sitting down with Biden, his soon-to-be chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, his three transition co-chairs, Jarrett, Rouse, John Podesta, and a handful of others, he began examining the possibilities for his cabinet. Most of the names on the lists were predictable, but one was not. Obama was leaning heavily toward Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. Among those most intimate with Obama, it came as no surprise. Since the summer, he had been telling Jarrett and Nesbitt that he wanted to find a role for Clinton in his administration. Obama's inclination was abetted by Podesta, whom he'd appointed to run a kind of pre-transition planning effort after securing the nomination, and whom Clinton had tapped, albeit prematurely, to handle the same task. At the first Podesta-led meeting to discuss potential cabinet picks in Reno, Nevada in late September, Hillary's name was on the lists for state and defense. The next morning, Jared asked Obama, "Are you serious about Senator Clinton?" Obama replied simply but emphatically, "Yes, I am." Obama shared his thinking with few people before Election Day, but when he did, his praise for Clinton was effusive. "She's smart, she's capable, she's tough, she's disciplined," Obama said again and again. "She wouldn't have to be taught or have her hand held. She wouldn't have to earn her place on the world stage. She already had global stature. She pays attention to nuance," Obama told Jarrett, "and that's what I want in a Secretary of State because the stakes are so high. I can't have somebody who would put us in peril with one errant sentence." Three other names were raised in the meeting at the Kleczynski Building: Daschle, Kerry, and Richardson. Daschle and Richardson were on the short list only as courtesies. Obama had other things in mind for both of them. Kerry was eminently qualified and desperately wanted the job, but he would have been a predictable pick. There was no wow factor with Kerry. Choosing Clinton would send a powerful message about Obama's bigness. Much of Obama's campaign brain trust was resistant to the idea. The suits were skeptical that Hillary would be, could be, a loyal team player. The arguments against her varied among them, but all were forcefully and fully aired. She would pursue her own agenda. She would undermine Obama's. She would be a constant headache. She came attached to her globe-trotting, buck-raking, headline-making husband, whose antics were the very antithesis of the no-drama Obama way of doing business. Jarrett was wary too, though her worries revolved around the question of the chemistry, or lack thereof, between Barack and Hillary. "You'd better really make sure that you two can work together," Jarrett advised the new president-elect, "because you can't just fire her." Obama listened to the objections and more or less dismissed them. Sure, he needed to sit with Clinton and get comfortable. Sure, the bill problem needed to be dealt with, but Obama shared none of his brain trust's lingering animus over the campaign. It was time to saddle up and get down to governing, and he saw Clinton as an invaluable asset. He told his quailing advisors to keep their eyes on the prize. More than once, he calmly reassured Jarrett, "She's going to be really good at this job." The following week, on November 13th, Hillary met with Obama in his transition office in Chicago. She had some theories about why she was there, but being offered Secretary of State was not among them. Two nights earlier, over dinner in New York with her and Bill, Terry McAuliffe had asked about the rumors swirling in Democratic circles that the gig might be tossed her way. "It's the craziest thing I've ever heard," Hillary replied. Not that she thought a job offer was out of the question, but she expected it to be a token unity gesture, something both sides knew she would almost certainly turn down, maybe Health and Human Services. When the chatter about state picked up, she assumed that the Obamans were floating it and was suspicious about their motives. "Why are they putting my name out?" she asked her friends. "How does it help them? What game are they playing?" But now, here she was, sitting alone with her former nemesis, and Obama was talking about the job in earnest. "You're head and shoulders above anyone else I'm considering," he said. Obama made it clear that they would have to come to terms regarding Bill's foundation and library funding, as well as his money-making ventures. He explained how he envisioned their relationship if she took the post. One president, one secretary of state, no overlap. He didn't formally offer her the job, but he left no doubt that she was his choice. Obama knew that Clinton would be reluctant, that he'd have to do some wooing. But at the same time, he was selling, he was also evaluating. Do we click? Will she respect the fact that I'm the president? Could she work for me? By the time the meeting was over, all those questions had been answered to his satisfaction. The conversation confirmed his instincts. He was surer than ever that he wanted Clinton, and he would do what it took to get her. Hillary's head, when she flew out of Chicago, was in a different place. "I'm not taking this job," she thought, "and I'm not going to let anyone talk me into it, anyone." But she also remembered a formulation that James Carville was fond of. "Once you're asked, you're fucked." That was precisely how Hillary felt for the next few days. She had less than zero interest in working for Obama, for doing anything other than going back to the Senate, licking her wounds, and putting her energies into paying down her multi-million-dollar debt. She was also looking forward to reclaiming some semblance of the life she'd had before the campaign, going to the theater, dining out, spending time with Chelsea. She was 61 years old and staring down the likelihood that she would never be president. And she was tired. Oh, so tired. The pressure on her to take the job was enormous, though, and all the more so because the whole drama was playing out in public. Hillary had flown commercial from New York to Chicago and been spotted on the plane. Then the press pool saw her three SUV motorcade pulling out from the garage of the Kleczynski building. Everyone Hillary encountered had an opinion, or rather they all had the same opinion, which was that she should accept. Being America's ambassador to the world at a hinge of history moment was a job commensurate with Clinton's skills, they argued. Biden was on the phone with her making that case persistently. So was Podesta. Emmanuel took a more aggressive tack. He told her she'd be making a big mistake if she turned it down, that a refusal would wound Obama before he even took office, that she had to play ball for her own sake as well as the party's. The conversations occasionally got heated. Voices were raised. Phones were slammed. There were other reasons for Clinton to say yes. The Senate wasn't proving as welcoming as she'd hoped, not by a long shot. She had come back thinking that her campaign had enhanced her status, that she could snag for herself some kind of plum position, a subcommittee chairmanship, a specially created health care panel, something. But Kennedy shot her down on health care, and Reid sidestepped her other requests. Behind the scenes, he and Schumer were beseeching the Obamans to take Hillary off their hands. The conspiratorial whisperers in the Senate were no longer whispering. They were telling her not to get ahead of herself, to take a seat, take a number. There was the bill factor, that unremitting source of speculation far and wide. The conventional wisdom held that the former president would be the death knell of the Madam Secretary scenario. Would he open the books and reveal the donors to the William J. Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative? He'd always fought that tooth and nail. Would he accept restrictions on his travel, his speaking, his business activities? Please! But the conventional wisdom couldn't have been more wrong. Faced with tough, unequivocal demands from the Obamans, demands that many of his people considered beyond the pale, Bill said, fine. Publicly and privately, he vowed to do whatever they want. There was no way he was going to let himself be cast as a stumbling block. Back-channeling regularly with Podesta, Emmanuel, and Biden, he became the loudest and most ardent voice urging his wife to take the job. Hillary felt the pull of patriotism and the call of duty. She believed that when the president asked a person to serve, there was an imperative to say yes. And yet, after 5 days of tumultuous to-ing and fro-ing, she decided to decline Obama's offer. Her reasons were many and, to her, dispositive. Secretary of State of all jobs seemed designed to turn her life upside down in myriad ways, in particular the constant travel and omnivorous jet lag. She felt protective of her husband, too, especially after the torching of his reputation in the campaign. No matter how willing Bill claimed to be, she didn't want to see his philanthropic efforts crimped, his important work helping the sick and underprivileged curtailed. And she kept coming back to the question of her debt. For some politicians, lumbering around millions of dollars in the red was no big thing. She considered it immoral. She wanted to be shed of the burden, and quickly. But how was she supposed to accomplish that as Secretary of State? Her people asked the Obamans again for help, but the transition team refused. And then there was something that she told one of her friends. She had spent a lot of years working for one guy and had no desire to do it again. On the morning of November 19th, the top officials of Hillary's and Bill's staffs held a conference call to coordinate the rejection, defend off charges that Bill's activities had thwarted the deal. They planned to send the full list of his contributors to Obama's transition office in Washington. Thousands of pages had to be printed out and rushed there that afternoon. Hillary informed Emanuel and Podesta of her decision. She wanted to talk to Obama to put the thing to rest. Emanuel and Podesta had a lot on the line. They'd been among Hillary's most forceful advocates internally, and now she was about to drop a heaping pile of public embarrassment in Obama's lap. The advisors decided that they had no choice but to stall. "The president-elect is unavailable for a call," they told Clinton. "He's indisposed." Hillary's staff tried to plan a time for the conversation. Again and again, it was pushed back. A 2:30 call was scheduled. At 2:17 p.m., Obadon sent around an email to Mills and others. "We hear that President-elect Obama will not do the call at 2:30. Instead, he wants her to talk to Podesta, talk to him in an hour, so 3:30? Hours later, Clinton had still not reached Obama. At 7:37, Obadon wrote, "The call has been scheduled for 10 p.m. Eastern." At 9:42, "God knows what's going to happen." At 10:27, "Call will not happen tonight." Clinton was in New York for a reception at Chelsea Piers commemorating the renaming of the Triborough Bridge in RFK's honor. She flew back to Washington late on a charter flight, arriving back at Whitehaven around midnight, and there, miraculously, she managed finally to reach the elusive Obama. "It's not going to work," an anguished Hillary told him. "I can't do it. It was a long, hard campaign, and I'm exhausted. I have this debt to pay down, and I can't do that as Secretary of State. I'm tired of being punched around. I feel like a piñata. I want to go home. I've had enough of this. You don't want me. You don't want all these stories about you and me. You don't want the whole circus. It's not good for you, and it's not good for me. I just can't do this." "Hillary, look, you're exactly right," Obama said. "Those are all real concerns. They're all real problems, and it's fair and legitimate for you to raise them. And the truth is, there's really nothing I can do about them. But the thing is, the economy is a much bigger mess than we'd ever imagined it would be, and I'm going to be focused on that for the next 2 years. So I need someone as big as you to do this job. I need someone whom I don't need to worry about. I need someone I can trust implicitly. And you're that person." Hillary raised a matter far more intimate than her personal reluctance. "You know my husband," she said. "You've seen what happens. We're going to be explaining something that he said every other day. You know I can't control him, and at some point he'll be a problem." "I know," Obama replied, "but I'm prepared to take that risk. You're worth it. Your country needs you. I need you. I need you to do this." For both Obama and Clinton, it was a strange and rare moment, one of almost incomprehensible candor and vulnerability. For nearly 2 years, Clinton's posture regarding her husband had been fierce and unyielding. Never once had she wavered in Bill's defense. Never once had she been anything but defiant in the face of his screw-ups. Only rarely had she ever acknowledged, even to her closest friends, the damage that he had inflicted on her candidacy. And yet now, here she was, laying down her guard with her former rival, admitting not only that her husband could be a thorn in her side, but, in effect, that she'd known it all along. Obama's tacit admission was equally revealing. As a public figure and a private man, his signal characteristics were supreme self-possession and self-reliance. He needed no one, was better and smarter, cooler and more composed than anyone around him. But here he was, in effect, conceding to Clinton that her help was crucial to the success of his presidency. For the first time, after all the bitterness and resentment that had passed between them as combatants, they had suddenly metamorphosed into different creatures with each other, human beings. It was nearly 1 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast. "I don't want this to be your final answer," Obama said quietly and in conclusion. "I want you not to say no to me. I want you to keep thinking. I want you to sleep on it." The next morning, Hillary Land prepared to announce Clinton's decision to the world. The previous day, she had signed off on a statement she would deliver before the cameras at a press stakeout site on the Senate side of Capitol Hill. It said, "I spoke this morning with President-elect Obama to convey my deepest appreciation for having been considered for a post in his administration. It is not something I sought or expected. In fact, it took me by surprise when he first mentioned the possibility a week ago. In the end, this was a decision for me about where I can best serve President-elect Obama, my constituents, and our country. And as I told President-elect Obama, my place is in the Senate, which is where I believe I can make the biggest difference right now as we confront so many unprecedented challenges at home and around the world." In Chicago, at the Kleczynski Building, Obama walked into Jarrett's office and told her where he was with Clinton. "She said no last night," Obama reported, "but she'd called him back that morning. She's going to do it," he said. Jarrett studied Obama. In the course of the campaign, their conversations had numbered in the thousands. She couldn't remember a time when he seemed prouder, more satisfied. It was November 20th. The election was 16 days in the past. But today, Obama had pulled off the grandest game changer of them all. On the brink of great power and awesome responsibility, he and Clinton were on the same team. This recording of Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin, and the Race of a Lifetime by John Heilemann and Mark Halperin was produced by Paul Rubin Productions and read by Dennis Boutsakaris. It was recorded by Tony Van Horn at John Marshall Sound. It was edited, mixed, and mastered by John Marshall Sound. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.
This audio program is presented by Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.